You have in front of you, or in your hand, the same verse of Scripture, Romans 1:18, written on the board, like a loop to Tigar, Orgy. Away from covering, revealed, uncovered, for wrath from God, theu op uranu, from heaven or out of heaven, is uncovered, epi possum, against all asebion, ungodliness, chi adikion, unrighteousness, anthropon of men, tone the ones. The truth holding in unrighteousness. That's the general statement. What follows is a horror story of the wrath of God uncovered now. What that state of those under God's wrath looks like. Some very famous writer once said, there can be no hell for most people worse than God answering their prayers, giving them what they want, because that's what most prayers aim for. I could go to Ephesians, where we read, ye were dead in trespasses and sin. To paraphrase it, under the rule of the prince of this world, your behavior was a behavior guided by the spirit of disobedience that rules this world. And as certain as a ship caught in currents that were driving it to the rocks, no effort of rowing could turn it back. It would take a sail unfurled, when I preached on that verse in Ephesians, analogized to faith and trust released, to catch sufficient wind that I analogize to the wind of the Spirit to blow the ship back from the rocks. Without that, no effort, no human effort. That's basically what is about to be described. Upo, away from, covering, shielded, or held back. And the timing is the same as the glorious news of the gospel. Paul is coming to Rome to let them know that something happened that changed the world. It changed it in potential for the better, and it changed it monumentally to the worse. That event of Christ's coming, that event that had flowed from the very first act that God performed. When following the sin of Adam and Eve, when they trusted Satan and his view of things as articulated to Eve, and doubted God and his statement of things, God comes seeking them. They didn't seek God, they were hiding. God comes seeking them. And though they covered themselves with leaves, he anticipates the redemptive plan, slays an animal, and covers them with the skin of the slain animal. Blood was shed, typifying that unfolded pattern of the Old Testament. For sin comes death. The life of the soul resides in the blood. And blood being spilled by the vicarious sacrifice was taken as a token through all the emblems, from the blood on the door of the slain lamb and the death angel passing over that initiated the Passover feast. He's teaching, teaching, teaching. There will be a way. And all these temporary sacrifices were bought up with the intrinsic value of the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And in the fullness of time, God sent his Son, and by the determined counsel, if he made the whole course and he finished it, his death and resurrection changed the world. The gospel was now available to every ethnic group. And the gospel, it uncovers a righteousness that is possible. Uncovered from heaven by the gospel, a righteousness from faith to faith, where God has the means of the new covenant, the New Testament, that for trust he will give position or standing before him of acceptability, impute to us righteous standing, but in addition, place in us, as we are connected by faith, the implant of his nature. That's why the evangelicals use the phrase born again. And the Bible's full of the phrases regeneration. We become new creation, new creatures in Christ Jesus. That is unveiled, uncovered, released, turned loose. A new way of salvation, a new way of righteousness, a righteousness from God from faith to faith. At the resurrection, when he sits at the right hand of God, able to dispense the same power that raised up him from the dead. And there is a phrase called, translated, handed over. Judas handed over. The same Greek word that's being translated here in Romans chapter 1. Handed over Jesus to those Roman soldiers. Jesus handed over to the Father his co-equal status. Turned loose of it, gave it to the Father, stepped into a tent of human flesh, born Jesus of Nazareth, and humbled himself unto death. Wherefore God hath highly exalted him, raised him, given him a name which is above every name, and the same phrase is used again, God handed over to him all kingdoms, all powers, everything, now in Jesus' hands. And when history spins on to that day of the end, when he comes as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And God says, behold, I make all things new, and creates a new heaven and a new earth. Same word in the Greek. Jesus will hand back to the Father all that power and authority. Pretty obvious they can trust one another. That age, unveiled, uncovered by the gospel, came to fruition, and the kingdom of God with power entered this world through the gospel at his resurrection. At the same time, a condition that had always existed apart from God. And let me use an analogy. I borrow from James Montgomery Boyce on this, who's probably, of all those who preach on the subject, has done the best. You can drop a porcelain vase in space, and it floats there, left to its own nothingness. It just floats there. Nothing's being done with it by a power that knows what's best for it. It just floats there. You drop a porcelain vase from that balcony up there, it ain't going to float. Gravity pulls it and smashes it. Or to use the analogy of the current that's putting the boat that I talked about earlier, pulling it toward the rocks. Instead of the wind blowing into the sails and taking it away from the rocks, the source of the wind puffs and blows it, gives it a push into the rocks. That's what's uncovered with the gospel. A condition of mankind that exists, for which the gospel brings rescue, is going to be worsened. God's going to give it an added push. Up from shield or hellbackness, to make up words, out from whatever held it back in the slightest, has been released. And I've told you the two words for wrath, themis and orge. Themis is from a root that means to snort and to pant. Raging, snorting mad. Versus orgy, which is a slow build-up. Boil. To the breaking point. That slow build-up of God's wrath for what exists among His creatures, for whom He had greater purpose, who turned themselves toward Satan instead of His truth, and the fruit of that evil, and their separateness from God, and their condition, apart from the light of His knowledge, as bad as it is, and His slow build-up of rage, to see the crowning product of His creation gone bad. At this same point of the release of the good news is the slow buildup of God's wrath from heaven against asabion, which you already know is non-God awareness. And last Sunday I spent enough time, since the only righteousness available to us is that of faith, thus to those who know that faith brings the gift of God's righteousness. For you, unrighteousness is non-faith. To those apart from the faith knowledge, unrighteousness is falling short of God's perfection. But to those with knowledge, a lifestyle of non-God awareness and fear and self-preservation instead of faith and trust makes you the target, not just of your condition, bad enough as it is, of housed in this temple of clay that Martin Luther said nullifies freedom. The world, the flesh, and the devil holds us prisoner. But like Pharaoh, who hardened his heart, when God decided, he added to it, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart more. That's what this verse is saying. The slow boil of God's wrath against your self-centered and my self-centered non-God awareness, and your self-centered and my self-centered self-preservation instead of running to the Sayer and trusting, makes us not only lack what the gospel provides, puts God finally releasing his slow buildup of wrath and giving us a push toward this. What is this? Verse 19. I'm reading, not from the King James, New Revised Standard Version, with occasional side comments about the Greek. The 18th verse is translated, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of those who by their holding it in unrighteousness, make themselves without excuse." They know better. "For what can be known about God is plain to them." It's not saying known in the sense that we can know God in personal experience. But what can be known about God is plain to them. And it is gnoston, that kind of knowledge, gnosis, the lack of which we call agnosis or agnostic, that is obtained through experience. The experience of man, all of us, through you are, is such that what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. So they are without excuse. You will read evolutionary theory and books that tell you that man proceeded from polytheism from animism to polytheism to monotheism, from worshiping objects, giving a reality to trees and rocks. Animals were gods, to multiple gods, and eventually he progressed to monotheism. Philosophy and history are my majors. I'm not going to waste your time with quotes, but there are abundant studies that prove the oldest religious urges and expressions, the most ancient in whatever, be it Egypt, Sumeria, Sumer, the Sumerian, Mesopotamian, original civilization, doesn't matter. The first instincts and the oldest roots from archaeology and philology, man started out worshiping a supreme being, one on top, no matter what they called him, how they described him. Monotheism is the most ancient religious expression in the history of man. You can get the tapes on my teaching about stars. The oldest tables of the house in the sky, or the houses in the sky. Oh, we go to astrologers now. And they'll tell you everything about you based upon the position of the heavenly bodies in this girdle of the earth and the sky that has these various signs. I was born in August. That makes me a Leo. For years, people thought Jesus was a Capricorn because he was born December 25th, they thought. No, he's born in September. That really messes up the astrology. And for God's sake, don't marry the wrong sign. And I used to hate the fact before my scholarship extended and I learned that Jesus was not born December 25th. You have no idea what it did to me. To know that the woman I married when I was 19 years old, that suddenly was revealed to be the devil's sister, was a Capricorn like Jesus. And here I was having to preach a gospel with a Christ who was a Capricorn when I wanted to kill everyone I saw. You can't imagine my joy when I discovered that Jesus was born in September. The oldest astrological charts start with Virgo, the Virgin, and end with Leo the Lion stomping on the dragon. Man started out with a knowledge and became corrupt, just as it says. And the heavens display his glory. There is an instinctive first reaction. The counter response is a learned response from the idiots described at the end of this chapter. The first response when you encounter creation and the mystery of life is, oh, there must be a source. The first response of man. The universe runs by a plan, and a plan requires a planner. Now, I attained the ability to decide that a first cause wasn't necessary, that infinite regression was no more difficult to believe than first cause, but that was a learned response. The initial reaction, you lay clues down as the creator. And anybody has encountered that sense of awe somewhere There's more to this than meets the eye. And the creation, the thousands of snowflakes, not one duplicated. The mystery of life. Oh, I know. Carl Sagan's a perfect example. He's one of the greatest students of the universe ever to live. He doesn't see God and the Russian astronaut. Lands out there in space and sneeringly says he didn't see God. Well, who set the gravitational plans in motion that gave him the chance to make his stupid statement? Now, am I saying it's impossible to doubt God in the midst of the universe? Am I saying that without any revelation, we're talking about natural theology here. Emil Brunner and Karl Barth, two neo-orthodox theologians, argued for years. One believed in it, the other didn't. Am I saying that the creation inevitably drives someone to a knowledge about God, that there is at least somebody in charge with power and creative ability? Even if he unraveled it with evolution, any geneticist will tell you mutations degenerate, do not improve. Ever since evolution came along, we've been led to believe, as they then moved it into psychology and into sociology, that there's some inevitable force that's making things get progressively better. Well, who's directing it? If that were true, but it isn't true. It's very apparent, and the Bible stands on this side of the fence, that man used to be smarter and better than he is and got worse. Even morons like us, if we could live 900 years, would learn something. We couldn't build the pyramid today. Oh, we revel in pi, the formula for squaring a circle. In the medieval period, they encased that in the pyramid thousands of years ago. You find the Dogon people in North Africa. Their whole worship pattern is built around a white dwarf that can't be seen. Wasn't discovered till the Middle Ages. Here's these natives in Africa whose entire religion is built around the cycle of this white dwarf that goes around Sirius, the dog star. Modern science confirms they exactly know its orbit. How do you find out? They wouldn't. Finally, some French archaeologists got the secret out of them. Then passed on orally, and it was brought to them by the fishman, who came from beyond the waters. Well, the Bible has extraterrestrials and UFOs. But the point I'm making is here's these people obviously inheriting a knowledge verbally of astronomy, the capacity of which to even see and find out about didn't occur until the latter part of the Middle Ages. Society hadn't gotten better. It's gone through stages and faced cataclysms and started over. And without excuse, God is saying, I didn't leave you in the dark. I laid out a creation that anybody but a moron would know that somebody out there and would start trying to find me. Doesn't mean they could find me. But it means if you say, God has left no evidence of His presence apart from the revelation through the contract relationship with the Jews, and now the New Testament, God is saying through Paul, not so. Without excuse. Ever since the creation of the world, verse 20, His eternal power, some power drives this universe. 25,000 years, the precession of the equinoxes, right on time. Ever since the creation of the world, His eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things He's made, so they're without excuse. For though they knew God, knew about Him, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. But they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, that's an interesting word. Claiming to be wise. Sophoi. Sophoi. Now that word is tacked on to philosophy. Sophoi. It is tacked into the word sophisticated. It's sophisticated now to not believe in God. So we claim to be sophisticated. We're sophoi. Let me read in the Greek. Because having known God, they glorified Him not as God, nor thanked Him. The word is Eucharistisan, from which we get Eucharist. Instead of going out and seeing the earth produce its food, and man mess it up, but the earth was a pretty good place. Instead of, let the scientists tell us, instead of being out there on some of these other uninhabitable planets, inhospitable places, with all the planets in just this one universe, the perfection of the relationships that produce oxygen. And we're worried now, you are environmentalists, about heating up. And we're seeing strange things happen to the climate as man continues to pollute. And I mentioned Masry, my old friend. He and Aaron were on the news this week talking to the city council about a chemical that's added to the Los Angeles water supply. And as only Ed Masry can say in his inimitable style, you know what they put it in there for? To inhibit rust. So that means you're drinking stuff to inhibit rust in your gut? I mean, rust is pretty tough stuff to get rid of. I'm not sure I want water that's designed to inhibit rust going into my boca. We pollute. We destroy with our greed. But God put us in a pretty good place. Instead of being thankful, Eucharistic, God's judging now. Having known God, they glorified Him not as God, nor did they thank Him. Why is it that so many words have entered our language for prayer that mean thanksgiving? I don't know how much praying you did this week. Only you and God know how much thanking of God you did. Well, a couple of times this week I felt like saying to God, I wish you'd tell me something to be thankful for. And if he had answered the prayer, he could have given a list. I'd still be standing in detention listening to. Most of our prayer is, gimme, 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 gimme. Woe is me. Gloom, despair, and agony on me. I'm guilty. I'm preaching to you as though I spend every day thanking God for all the things that I should be thanking Him for. And how many words that mean prayer really translate as thanksgiving? Eucharist. That means thanksgiving. The Latin word, gratia, and it comes, I got to give them credit in the Latin languages. Tai molto grazie. They're carrying it right in from the Latin. Muchos gracias from the Spanish. But it's synonymous with prayer, too. That's where we get the basis for, would you say, grace at the table? Because thanksgiving is synonymous with prayer. In its etymological roots, seldom the case in our performance. Don't raise your hands, but how much of your praying time this past week was spent thanking God? And as with me, most of you should be tucking your head. God is saying, without excuse, my footprints are everywhere. My fingerprints are everywhere to those who want to look. Imagine for a moment your explanations of all this. Empty, formless, chance, accident, mechanism. Because we don't want to believe in God. As I said earlier, man doesn't like a God. Because man doesn't want a boss. Man doesn't want to do it God's way. Without excuse. They knew God, didn't honor Him as God, give thanks to Him, but they became vain, the Greek has it, empty, in their reasoning. The word for reasoning is dialogismos. Dialogismos. From which we get dialogue. Dialectic. There's nothing makes you more empty in your reasoning than running off at the mouth all the time. Arguing. Arguing. Well, something is said. I beg to differ. My aunt Swim. Her pet theological opinion gets challenged. Right there's where I differ with the Word. Yeah. Now God's sitting up here, you know. The real tragedy is we don't want to think about Him. We want to live in a state of non-God awareness. I mean, what? He's up there. He's not paying any attention. It doesn't matter that Jesus said, every hair of your head is numbered. He knows how many came out this morning. He knows those that you colored. We don't believe this. That God sees sparrow fall. Well, who said that? That ain't some theologian. That's Jesus Himself, God incarnate, telling us God's paying attention. Now, He's up there. I don't want to have to live with God awareness. That's uncomfortable. Makes big brothers out of all of us. in the Big Brother event. God's watching me. How many of you, as you went through your morning activities today, thought about the fact God's looking at you? Jesus too. Watch him lace that up out of pride. Watch your paint over that. I want you to know I gave him a pretty good show today. Now, I'm honest enough to say I never really thought about him watching me a couple of times. I really didn't. So he's up here. We don't want to have to remember if he sees a sparrow fall, he sees me. I want to concoct things in my brain that make me not have to accept his footprint. We're not even in the arena of direct revelation. That's the next chapter. Where those that have been honored by God, and in addition to his general footprints, he selected them and shined a light and told them in detail. We're talking about all the rest. All who live with no God awareness, no conformity to his contract, which gives the way out now by simply trusting. Ah, there's some other explanation. I'm going to dialogue with him a while. Okay, let's carry on with the Greek. Knowing God, they glorified him not as God, nor thanked him, but became vain or empty in their dialoguing, their reasoning of them or among them, and was darkened. Their heart, auton cardia, was darkened, eskotisthi, and made senseless, professing to be wise, sophisticated, philosophy, they became foolish. Listen to this, foolish. Emora, emoron, theson. Emoron, theson. They became morons. Well, I think this is the way it happened. I wish I could bring a painting I did that, since the scientists poke fun at those who believe in creation, I painted a large painting called The Big Bang. It's not allowed for public consumption. But I'm telling you, it stops any and everybody in their tracks. And it produces all kinds of evil thoughts. I think I may put it down in the meditation room and charge admission to see it. Because I decided I was going to, since they, with humor and ridicule, would write God out of the universe and ask me to accept it all happened with the Big Bang. Well, at least the Big Bang can be entertaining. How many in this audience that are staff and friends have seen my painting, The Big Bang? Would it get attention, Carl?
Yes, sir.
If I'd let him, Carl would sleep as an art lover in his presence. So, these morons, they became moronic and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into a likeness of an image, an ikonos, of corruptible man and birds and quadrupeds and reptiles. Now we want to eliminate ourselves from that category because we have advanced beyond the primitive people who have given animal names to the signs in the heavens, and who worship animals and reptiles. And we're not one of them, so we ignore the first category, those who worship man. In essence, they worship the creature instead of the Creator. Now, immediately, they become God. These morons who don't want to read from God's footprints that there is someone out there, they want to create a God for themselves and worship the corruptible instead of the incorruptible. Therefore, since they changed an incorruptible God whose wisdom, power, and footprints are everywhere into something of their own selection and control, God gave them over, handed them over. They may have been on the cusp of fighting the passions of desire . But since the footprints of God are ignored and you exchange the clear handwriting that should say, I don't understand who, but he has to be there somewhere, and look for a revelation. Or at the very least, don't create a substitute. And you reduce God with your sophistry and moronic dialogue down to something less than you. Doesn't matter whether you do it in a sophisticated way, like Dershowitz, who sits in judgment on God and explains the things he doesn't like, but God learning through his mistakes, until he finally becomes a God that Dershowitz can approve. Since you don't want to accept the incorruptible, eternal, and divine, but reduce it down to you and yours. God, this is the slow wrath of God breaking forth. Since you choose not to be aware of God, but put other things in its place, from the ignorant savage who worships animal icons, to the sophisticated moron who by his dialogues elevates himself as the judge of everything. Since you don't seem to even want to accept a power that can run the universe and needing its help with you, God hands you over. And all of a sudden, instead of trying to rescue from the grip, he pushes you in to the mess and hands you over as slave of your passions and your desires. They exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling a mortal human being. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the degrading of their bodies among themselves. Then it goes one step further. They exchange the truth of God. They exchange the incorruptible for the corruptible. Now he says, verse 25, who changed metalloxin, the truth, aletheon, holding it in unrighteousness, they changed the truth of God into the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the one having created, who is blessed into the ages. Amen. Not only do they refuse to acknowledge His divine reality and power, not only do they refuse to say the footprints mean someone is walking, they change the truth of God revealed everywhere of His power and control into a lie. He doesn't exist. The only control I will recognize or desire or want is my control. I worship the creature rather than the Creator. In one case, it's against God's existence. In another case, further down, it's against God's ways. Therefore, God turns them over. These are the harsh words the present society doesn't even want to have read in public. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, for this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. Ignoring God's reality, He gave them up to their passions. Ignoring and denying God's control and substituting the creature for the Creator and putting the creature first, which is yourself, rather than the Creator, knowing no boundaries, exchanging the truth of God's control for a lie. God gives them up to their lie. Gives them up. Hands them over. For this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. The women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, and in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men, and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error. Now let me say, I do not believe that last line is justification for some preacher saying AIDS is punishment for homosexuality. Neither will I be caught in the trap reading what Paul said of elevating homosexuality or the gay lifestyle to the unpardonable sin above all sins. And I'm on record saying gay people are welcome in this church. The problem with most preachers on this subject is that in the next giving over, there will be 21 different sins that come out of the depraved mind, and I might as well go to that third one. The third thing they do is because God, I'll paraphrase it, did not come out as they wanted Him to be, subject to their testing, using the same word that in the book of Hebrews, God says He turned on the Israelites because instead of recognizing they were on trial, they put God to test, like a metallurgist tests metal. And He poured His wrath on them. And Paul in Romans 5 will say, we're to joy in tribulation, the word from tribulum, which is the rod that whips the wheat and separates the chaff from the wheat. Because tribulum produces, the King James says patience, but the Greek is endurance. And endurance produces, and you've heard me quote it and translate it, triedness. And triedness produces the hope you'll make it all the way. The word that I'm translating, triedness, is the same word that in the next passage, mankind has been subjecting God to this test. And your dialogue with one another and your moronic sophistication has concluded that your view of things is the right one. There is no God. Or if he is, he ain't looking. Or if he is, he's reconstructed in an image that you can approve. And having come to that conclusion that you have this right of judgment on God and that you can't approve of the God that is, the third handover, God hands you over to a mind that he doesn't approve. In other words, you think God didn't pass your test, your whole dialogue instrument, your whole moronic sophistry, your whole view of things comes from a mind that he turns a screw on and makes it even more disapproved than it was, like putting Pharaoh more hardened than he was. He turns your mind into a cesspool. And out of that cesspool mind come 21 itemized sins. One of them is gossiping. Now, I don't know any church, evangelical or otherwise, that wants to be, I'm going to worry about you, you carnal crowd, with the puns, but it's going to be as hard on gossipers as they are on homosexuals. That's my quarrel. We'll come into the third chapter. All have sinned. But without the gospel, now that the gospel is available, all those natural tendencies are aggravated and accelerated by God himself. He's fed up now. He's provided a way out and an answer. And if you don't respond to it, you don't receive it, you are going to be pushed into slavery to your passions, slavery to unnatural passions. You won't accept a supreme being, so he'll push you into slavery to the creature. You won't accept God's control exhibited in the perfection of the universe, so he will push you into unnatural slavery to passion. Now, the gay community has a lot of trouble with this verse. I just said, I will not allow it to be taken, isolated, and maybe put in the category of saying that that sin is any more unforgivable or any worse than these 21 other sins that every person in the sound of my voice, here or out there in radio and TV listening areas, some one or more of the 21 were guilty of. And your sinful tendencies to protect the creature and to worship the creature and to commit those other 21 which flow from the state of mind that doesn't... Now, you really can't apply this because most of you are the target in the next chapter because you have been the beneficiary of revealed knowledge. You've been the beneficiary of God telling us. Paul here is addressing everybody, those never heard of Christ. but have seen the footprints of God and still are without excuse because they inevitably yield to the tendency to worship the creature rather than the Creator, to rebel against God's way of doing things, His law, and want to change everything for their benefit, which is why we have the environmental problems of today. And they go into a depraved mind. These are people without knowledge. You need to wait till the next chapter. But there are 21 other vices. And everybody who teaches on this chapter want to create a separate state of being. Hey, divorce is a sin. When I was elected pastor, they had it in the bylaws. You can't be even an officer or teacher in the church and be divorced. And they asked me to be pastor. I said, what are you talking about? I'm divorced. And I don't care. Even if you married what I married. If you got a conscience and an ounce of decency, there has to be some blame on both sides. The issue is what you do when you're busted and you're... And I wasn't the one that was unfaithful in any relationship I ever had. I stood in front of this congregation and said, I got about one more trip left in me. I'm going to surround myself with temptation that's good enough. If I fall, it's worth a trip. Didn't I tell you that? I said, you ain't going to catch me with some shameful incident like Jimmy Swaggart. And I said publicly, I thought his motel trip was bad taste. I could teach him a thing or two about that. It was his perfectionism and hypocrisy. And I said, I have to have somebody with me with security and media and all the things that go on. I'm either going to have men with me or women with me. And by God, if stories are going to be told about this pastor, it's going to be on what I consider to be the right side of the street. Who's up at the house with Doc? Well, Rod's up there with him. Who's sleeping in the house with Doc in case he has an emergency? You know, he's worth a lot to this corporation. Mick? I told you honestly. There's going to be beauty there sleeping with me. Didn't I tell you that? I try to tell you, Doc, paint black, white. But I also told you I had 15 years. When you read in the Bible, the bishop shall be the husband of one wife, you need to know the Greek. It is a one-wife kind of man. There are lots of bishops dragging along one wife they hate. And no woman in the congregation safe from their lusting looks and perverted thoughts. I don't have to work at it. I'm a one-woman kind of man. It's impossible for me to be different. I just made up my mind I was going to associate with a spectrum that would make sure that when I yielded to that godly tendency that I hate in the natural. I've told you. As a preacher's kid, it was a sin to breathe in my little fundamentalist atmosphere I grew up in. And then I grow up and study the Bible and learn the things that I wanted to do that were sin, I was told. God ain't that... No, He ain't going to kill you on the spot for doing it. And then I am set free by the gospel. Now I can commit those sins. And damn it, I don't want to. It's awful. It's awful to know how many sins I could do right now as defined by the deacons in my church. I don't want to do. Now, the tragedy is they were right about some of them, but they didn't know why. They gave me the wrong reasons. If salvation is regeneration, and if for faith God puts His nature in you, and when you have the Spirit of Christ, you have the mind of Christ, then the fruit of the Spirit will grow through you. Your nature begins to change. There's a war between the old man and the new. But each of these 21 vices and the passions that get the most treatment by Paul are going to be displaced and dimmed as the new life in Christ and the new creature in you begins to dominate and displace the old. The gospel unveils hope. The gospel unveils change. The gospel unveils standing with God and His life working through you if you trust. And that includes every person who is worshiping the creature instead of the Creator when the gospel hits them. It includes every creature prone to believe a lie of his own moronic, so-called sophisticated dialogue, who is silenced by the revelation of the gospel. It includes every creature that in the natural state would yield to passions and rebel against God's way of doing things. But it's all sin. I don't take a particular class and say you can't. I say send every sinner in town to church. You're all welcome here. Send the sinners here. But don't give me this hogwash that says a sin isn't a sin. I'm teaching Paul, and this is what Paul has to say. And there are people who craftily use the Scripture who want to say Paul didn't say what he said about the unnatural sexual passions. The traditional interpretation, I'm reading from John Stott, well respected around the world, like me, recognizes we're all sinners in need of grace, and that the gospel gives us the opportunity for God to conform us to His image, instead of us conforming God to our image and justifying it. The traditional interpretation that they describe and condemn these verses, homosexual behavior, is being challenged with a gay lobby. Three arguments are advanced. First, it is claimed that the passage is irrelevant on the ground that its purpose is neither to teach sexual ethics nor to expose vice, but rather to portray the outworking of God's wrath. This is true, but if a certain sexual conduct is seen and to be seen as the consequence of God's wrath, it must be displeasing to Him. And as I say, fornication, adultery, all of those things. I don't really believe that we can justify human behavior by rabbits. Never know any better. One scientist compared human beings to rats, and he was challenged in the classroom as being denigrating. He said, yes, I agree. I should correct. It is denigrating to the rats. As Niebuhr said, we're not willing to sin and cry out to God for His better way, we must convince ourselves and others that sin's not sin after all. And I'm saying, even while Stott talks about this, we are just as guilty of justifying the other 21 vices, which you can read in your own King James Version. It's pretty good there. Secondly, they argue, the likelihood is that Paul is thinking only about pederasty, homosexuality with pedophiles, since there was no other form of male homosexuality in the Greco-Roman world, and that he's opposing it because of the humiliation, exploitation experienced with the youths involved. Now that's how moronic people can twist history to try to serve an argument when the right answer is, we have sinned. Whatever explanation, we all fall short of the outraying of God's glory and the conforming to His way of doing things. Now, I really think God could have figured out a way. I mean, if you study all the evolutionary species, taking that frame, there are some strange ways of producing offspring. Now, God could have said, Adam needs companionship. And this is the ideal relationship. And I, you know, there are lots of times I wish He had done it this way. I really do. Why He had to introduce broads on the face of this earth, I don't know. Why didn't God say, let's be creative. Let's do what the Bible says. Reproduce. Out of His bowels came so-and-so. Isn't that what you read in the King James? David was born from the bowels of... Haven't you ever read that in the King James? I mean, it really bothered me as a kid to see all these people that the Bible said came out of their bowels. Did you not read the Bible through as a kid or ever see those passages? Well, now I know that it really didn't happen. But come to think of it, God could have done it. He could have let them come out in a little encased plastic bag or something. I mean, Adam and his male counterpart needed on occasions to check their stool. I am not putting the gays down. They're welcome in my church. Their contributions to the arts. Some of my friends that have qualities I wish some heterosexuals had. I have said publicly my biggest complaint with the gay community is their lack of fidelity and promiscuity. And I'm on record as saying from an ethical standpoint, a good gay relationship is better than a bad heterosexual from an ethical standpoint. I can even see the validity of the arguments that a child may get more loving care with gay parents than some nightmare households that are heterosexual. That's why I tell you over and over again, don't mix ethics with righteousness. Some ethics are better than other ethics. And I am saying again and again, there's 21 other vices here. But don't expect me to corrupt what Paul teaches by saying Paul was only talking about pedophile homosexual acts. Thirdly, this is by John Boswell. He wrote the book Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality, University of Chicago Press, 1980, if you want to read it. Thirdly, there's the question what Paul meant by nature. Some homosexual people are urging that their relationships cannot be described as unnatural, since they're perfectly natural to them. I believe that it's perfectly natural to them. I believe there are genetic tendencies to alcoholism. I believe there are genetic tendencies and chromosome imbalance that makes some people cruel and murderous. I don't doubt, our modern understandings of hormones and sexuality, we've got sex changes all the time going on. I don't doubt that there's genetic pressure. I'm sure I have a genetic pressure to hate all women. It's an imbalance in my nature to love what I hate. I know they're superior, and I hate it. Don't even talk to me about feminism and fairness. If women ever get on top, they ain't ever yielding the ground. We're done for, men. I'm one of the last in the wilderness that knows women are superior. God is like riding a horse. Don't let him know he can kill you. Don't. I ain't giving way. Don't even talk to me about fairness. I ain't going to be fair. I want to enjoy it. As long as the dominance of the male is there, we are inferior, brethren, but let's take advantage of it. I don't want anybody beating women or abusing women. I just want to be the head of my house. Perfectly natural. John Boswell has written, for example, that the persons Paul condemns are manifestly not homosexual because it's perfectly natural for them. They have a genetic trait. So therefore, what Paul has to be derogating are homosexual acts committed by apparently heterosexual people. Hence, Paul's statement that they abandon natural relations and exchange them for unnatural does not refer to natural homosexuals, but to you heterosexuals that are invading their territory. Richard Hayes has written a thorough exegetical rebuttal of this interpretation and provides ample contemporary evidence that the opposition of natural, kata, Hazine, an unnatural, paraphazine, was very frequently used in the New Testament world to distinguish between homosexuals and heterosexuals. People go flame out on this. They don't want to listen. I expect to be misunderstood. So I repeat it again. There are things in God's way of doing things that run against our self-centered, self-serving, as Freud says in that circle I draw so often, the pleasure principle, avoid pain, seek pleasure. And as I said earlier, we want God to approve our way. I can drink wine. I have no history that I know of in alcoholism in my family. I don't want to hear somebody telling me the wine Jesus turned from water at that feast was not fermented. And I don't want to hear some nut tell me that the wine that Paul told Timothy to take was grape juice and not wine. And wine all through the Bible. If I can drink wine with a meal and I've never been drunk in my life. I'm fascinated with the excellence and work and dedication and everything about winemaking, like the Bible. It teaches me a lot about what God is doing to bring forth the best in us. I'm not a preacher who camps out on sins. That's why I'm skipping as many verses as I have camped out for months. I've gone from the 19th verse to the 31st verse already today. Sin is sin. We all stand in it. We all buck against God's way of doing things. We all suffer the tragedy of mistakes made and the consequences that follow. We all find ourselves, as I did. I didn't think I was fit to be a pastor because of a carryover vestigial of tradition that a divorced man cannot be a pastor. But I really think this made me better able to understand that heartache that seeps through any congregation. Again, gays are welcome. Liars, gossipers, sinners of all 21 other kind in this chapter need God's grace. And having confronted it, that's the pain. That's the war I went through this whole week from Sunday afternoon until now. That those that ought to be closest to the message demonstrate, apparently, absolute lack of God awareness. They know the truth better than anybody. Not only the message is, I'm private tutoring them in correction day in and day out. And it tears my gut out to have standing right in front of me an incapacity to repent, a repeated, self-serving, self-justifying, opaque wall that doesn't cry out, oh, I see it, against thee, O God, am I sinning? Help me and take the grace. And I sit there knowing that I got a problem. I've told you about the same drunk I saved 13 times in Orville. I keep trying. I hear the sorry sir routine when they've been busted and all excuses. I've lost my voice, breaking the excuses apart. And then, with nowhere else to go, I get the sorry sir. Give me another chance. But like cue cards, they're coming out of the brain. How do I turn this blowtorch off? And I'm sitting there in a panic, more than they are. Has it happened to this one? I mean, the devil, sorry, he'd rather have some of the key people on which this ministry relies than some of you on the fringe. If he wants to bring this ministry down. And I sit there saying, has it happened? They apparently don't see it. They obviously have no God awareness because they've been exposed telling me lies to justify themselves that God already knew. And I'm sitting there saying, what this chapter that I'm teaching says is there is a point where God hands you over. He just hands you over. I know the unpardonable sin is scary, but that's what the Hebrews letter is warning about. Once started, don't draw back. Once laying your hand to the plow, don't look back. The tragedy of modern American Christianity is you're calloused on these things. You will stand right there, having performed any one of these 21 sins, forgetting homosexuality, acting as though God doesn't exist, knowing the truth, but still worshiping the creature more than the Creator, and nothing is as important as protecting your goddamn miserable little selfhood. You cuss? No, it's God damned. It's what it's saying. God turns you over. And the mark, the consequence, not my spirit will not always strive with man. No man cometh to the Father save the spirit growing. And I'm seeing as those scales off my eyes, there are some of these people, they have been turned over. And here I am in the unenviable position of really being against God, trying to save them and trying to get them to see it when they can't see it. The state is reprobate. You are turned over, the last phrase says, handed over to a non-approved by God reprobate mind. And here I am, trying to get a spiritual thought out of an alien brain. From people who know the truth and are trying to find a new way to express it self-justifyingly, to take the heat off, with no consequence in their mind. I'm worshiping the creature. Everything else are just symptoms. I'm worshiping the creature. And nothing's worse than the second, third generation Christian that has become so familiar. I do not believe the sons of Eli ever had a conscience-paying moment. At least Judas went out and hanged himself. I have more hope for him. In some moment while he was strangling, praying for God's grace, than these people that are past feeling, turned over to a strong delusion, believing a lie. Oh, God wouldn't turn on me. Well, absolutely not, because you've made you the God. I mean, God's so lucky to have you. There's no way, this state of mind, no matter what I do, I'm so in love with this creature, God will never turn on me. The wrath of God is now being poured out from heaven against no God awareness and no righteousness, including trusting Him for the righteous gift. I'm not telling the people to stop doing the 21 things that are listed there, and I'm not preaching and telling people to stop being homosexual. Maybe you got a genetic influence. I'll tell all of you, you can't deliver yourself. This is not a willpower matter. And my heart goes out to those people with a proneness for whatever your sin is because of either background, environment, genetic influence, beatings and blows from life. But I preach the gospel that if trust and self-denial and God first is your mode of operation, you can't deliver yourself from anything, but you can trust God and His life, and you will deliver you. That's the message of faith. That's my message for today. Offering time. Now, this is a painful message if you're willing to face yourself. I know what you'd rather have me do. Get on this old-fashioned symbol of the church. You would much rather. Get close up on it. Get, move your camera. Get over here. Get right in front of it. Stand right there. Get on that. Now, if I had itching ears and wanted to just come and please you today, I could have preached this message. I could have let the fish do it. Listen. Go to a church that preaches that message, or do you want to go to a church where Paul's message is unfolded that makes us face ourselves as we are, but gives the hope that God Himself will deliver us from that which is not supernatural, His way, if we put our trust in Him? You've got to have faith. I don't major on sins. That's not been the thrust of my ministry for these 25 years. But the truth is the truth. There is a God. He changes not. He set in motion His ways. He now in love and grace will empower us to be like Him if we trust Him. But He's not going to let us recreate Him in our image and substitute our ways for His ways, whatever they are. This is a church that welcomes all sinners struggling in this devil rule, prince of the power of the air, evil world. The warning of Paul today is return to God awareness as your habit pattern and trusting God as the way to receive His righteousness. And lo and behold, the fruit of the Spirit in you, the mind of Christ in you and His nature in you will make all of us more and more like Him and less like the self we have been, and less needing to justify the self that we have been. That's the message of this chapter. I'll be in the second chapter, believe it or not, next Sunday. I hope you'll be here. And don't fail in your making your calls regarding volunteering at King's One to get it ready for November 5th. The song is My Heavenly Father Watches Over Me. Good day, folks.